This podcast is supported by Hannover Messe, your meeting place for the industrial community.
Hello everybody and welcome to a new episode of our Industrial AI podcast. My name is Robert Weber and it's a pleasure to talk to...
What is there to laugh about, Robert?
I don't know.
Good morning, Robert. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Okay.
What about you?
Oh, yeah, I'm fine as well. I already had my exercise this morning.
Oh.
I went to the bakery, which, why do I need to walk about half an hour in one direction, so a complete hour back? We have snow here.
Okay.
So it was my personal exercise. But the trigger is like, you know, we don't have people... Because there's a bakery just next door almost, and they, since a couple of months, can't find any people to stand in the shop.
Okay.
Which I guess is a general problem also for us in the industry.
Absolutely.
That's why we're here to talk
AI about it. Will solve everything.
Well, at least there is the potential for, you know, supporting for improving effectiveness.
Absolutely. Peter, let's keep the news section a little bit shorter because you recorded a very big episode with Andri. But in the beginning, I spoke to Stefan Mills from SpleenLab again because the guys have presented an AI agent for drones video. And that's actually your topic, but let's listen to Stefan first. Stefan, you shared a video with a drone and your software platform, and then came the magic word, AI-based agent. Peter immediately pricked up his ears, I would say, and explain us why you are now also in the AI agent hype and what can the agent do and how does it work?
Yeah, good question. So first of all, thanks for having me. As you know, we are working now for years on embedded AI, especially enabling robotics, drones, cars, and we see a tremendous demand now on next generation models. We call them foundation models. And as we are now working for years, it was just a logical step to go a step further. So creating a full based of our modules will solving some tasks you give to him.
And how does it work?
Yeah, it's mainly... You know the current large language models,
sure.
Right? They are capable of reasoning and they are trained on a tremendous amount of data. And then there are these more traditional AI algorithms like object detection and tracking. And all these needs to run in real time in combination with current control engines. And in the air, these are typical flight controllers.
Mm-hmm. That's difficult, right?
So that's the hardest part, to be honest, right? Also, people think training foundation models is the hardest part, but I guess this combination is quite harder because you need to be quite good at embedded and robotics and real-time operation systems.
And how does it work, the agent? And how do you combine both worlds now?
Yeah, this is exactly the logical step. So you know all these object detection models, right? Like YOLO, YOLO V8, YOLO V11. These are classically trained. And then the next step, there are grounding approaches, right? Like grounding Dino or all these approaches where you prompt with a text and combine this object detection to get something out of it. And then we have all these reasoning models, multimodal models that are capable of reasoning what they see in a scene. And if you now interact with a human with reasoning, then it's quite easy to put this all together. For example, imagine a firefighter, right? Who's not capable of steering a drone because he has to do, in an emergency case, lots of things. And then he's still telling the drone what to do. And the drone is at some point able to reason a scene. So he can tell the drone, start now, follow me, fly to a specific coordinate, and then tell me what you see. And this is overall quite a robotic combination of these end-to-end models we have combined with our classic solutions.
But reasoning needs a lot of power, right? So how do you manage that?
Yeah, this is also a really important problem. You need to deploy these large modules on a small embedded GPU, right?
Small embedded GPU. Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, right? If you think about 10 years ago, but this is the case, right? We deploy then 7B models quantized on these engines. We schedule all these ML algorithms that they don't have to run at the same time. There are also schedulers, which are used state machines, and then you can combine all the together, right? And this makes it so efficient to work on a small embedded platform.
So drones is a very specific industry. Can you transfer your approach to, let's call it, humanoids, robots, traditional robotic applications?
Yeah, we can for sure deploy. So we are also on the UXV vertical, so meaning all unmanned vehicles. Also on the ground, this is directly deployable exploration or in space. Human needs are very, very complex in terms of control. So we not focusing yet on the control part, but also there on the localization, on the reasoning part. So yeah, it's easy to be transferred, but we have seen not such a solution yet at the drone space. That's why we focused on it on a first glance.
Okay, what are the next steps?
Yeah, the next step is to explore the real applications, as I told you, firefighters, or also security. I guess these are very important use cases where this could become reality very soon. We are also lots of inquiries in that direction. And yeah, I'm really excited to create value out of what we have.
Stefan, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you as well. And thanks for having me again.
So what Stefan and his team are showing is very impressive. An agent to control the drone, to give them exercises, tasks. I was very impressed by that.
Yeah, me too. He shared it a week or two ago on LinkedIn, I believe, right?
Yeah.
And I shared it with a friend of mine, Håkan, a Swedish friend. And he started playing with drones, really as a consumer. And that's why. And he was talking about, what did he call it? It's the driver's seat, I think he calls it. So there's a mode where you're not standing on the ground and your head goes up and you see the drone. No, you're inside. So it makes you fly. And that's exactly, of course. And then, of course, we now look into the professional side of doing things with drones. And did I see a message just overnight that we're going to have Stefan join
exactly
us in the Alps with a drone even?
Yeah, we are planning a live demo with the AI agent drone at AI in the Alps. We are currently checking the framework, the conditions, talking to the mountain rescue service, and hopefully we will get the green light, but I'm very happy. Yeah.
All right, yeah. That's the legal side, I guess.
Exactly.
You cannot just fly around wherever you want, right?
Exactly. But I also think that it could be very interesting for the mountain rescue service to see what is possible with the drones. If you think about an avalanche or something, and the drone will now point out, oh, there are people, maybe there are people. Please show me all the possibilities. Yep.
And as always, for you, dear listener, good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you are. As always, this is very important that if we talk now in this case about drones, and some of you think, drones, what is that all about? You know, I thought this was the Industrial AI podcast. Well, I think number one, we do not that often, and we should at some point in time also talk about the process industry. So whenever we talk process industries, so the huge facilities, you know, related to chemistry, for example. Of course, there's a wonderful use case, right? We're having, and I think that's happening already, you know, the drones flying around the facility. But at the same time, you know, what about logistics or big factories? You know, I'm very much looking forward to learn more from Stefan there, what is going to be possible with drones also included in or embedded in our industrial world.
Exactly. And we should talk about defense, right? Because the defense industry is a big industry, right?
Now, that is very interesting. I today only have two topics, but only one short.
I'm sure what you will tell us. Yeah.
It's actually the defense one. And you and I talked about it. We say we never talk politics. We're never going to continue to do that. And then defense is, it's at least like a sensitive topic. But I'm going to announce it. I'm going to share this very quickly. It's a company called Helsing and Mistral AI. They announced their partnership. And they're going to build the next generation AI systems for human-machine collaboration in the, as you said, defense sector. Now, they're going to be focusing on robotics and the AI for Europe's, quote-unquote, future security prosperity. Now, that's where I'm not going to go into the details. Yes, we're in a difficult situation. Globally, we just had a security conference here in Munich. There was a lot about Europe last week. I'm not sure we're going to talk about that a little bit. Now, yes, from both, also in this press announcement, from Helsing co-founder, that's Gunbert Scherf, as well as from the Mistral CEO, Arthur Mensch. Very sensitive topic.
So what they are building? They're building a world robotics model? Or what is the role of Mistral?
Oh, what I saw, they're producing drones, actually.
Okay.
No, really?
Yeah.
The topic you start with. I think they now just finished a factory with an output of, did they say, 1,000 drones? But I don't know. I am still very interested. So Gunbert, if you're listening, or somebody from Helsing, I did send Gunbert a request for a podcast. I didn't hear from him yet. Maybe I should try also with Arthur. Would, of course, in general, be very interesting to be talking also to Mistral at some point in time. And this was put in this environment. Again, I'm not sure we're going to talk about this big. Was it now also 100 billion or 150 billion? Macron, a president, there was a big thing. Europe Week. Sometimes I get a little bit bored on this topic of Europe. So that's why I chose I'm very much interested in sharing with you, dear listener, what is really happening and what can you really use. But of course, it was put in this environment of, you know, Europe waking up and doing.
But it's interesting because you mentioned it's a tricky discussion when it comes to defense, right? But from my point of view, when it comes to AI and when it comes to industrial products also, everything is dual use, right? So you can find connectors in machines. You can find connectors in tanks. You can find AI models in cars. You can find AI models in drones. So we need to redefine what means defense and what means dual use. Or am I wrong, Peter?
Well, no, I don't think I don't think you're wrong. It's but already starting to talk about it, there is a certain group of people which immediately and you recall that, but that's, I think that's 2018. Is it really that long time ago that there was a huge part of the Google employees? They went against their management working at that time, I believe, for the US defense agency, right? DARPA. Is that DARPA, I believe?
DARPA, yeah.
And then Google changed, and they just re-changed. So Google just dropped, just a week ago, its promise to not use AI for weapons. So it seems to be the sign of the times. And that's not written, not done by just anybody. It's done by Damis Hassabis, which I really, really respect, as one of the top five global AI guys. And I'm going to close off today's news with a quote from him, actually. So that's happening. And yes, but nevertheless, and I did share this information on LinkedIn, and immediately there was a person, and I appreciate, I'm open to any of these ideas, but still, yes, I would say, you know, this is what is happening, and it's industrial, and if one of you listeners says, I don't want anything to do with it, that's a private decision, I believe, and that is always possible, also in other areas, I think, where people say, oh no, I don't want to have anything to do with that, but it's this is what's happening, I think.
Absolutely. I want to come back to our event, AI in the Alps, because the group is complete again. We have new faces. Stephanie from Mercedes will be there, Koshkun from Sandvik, Niels from SICK, everybody. Welcome to our group. We are already looking forward to see you in July this year in Zug am Arlberg.
Great. I have only one main topic, actually. It's I went back to the roots of industrial AI. I think you saw that.
What
did I do? I asked ChatGPT. I'm not sure which one it was. Was it Mini 3 question? I don't know. And I asked who first used the term industrial AI and why. I'll come to that in a moment. But of course, I mean, that's the center of what we do, our podcast. You just talked about our conference, all the things we do. All it took was about a minute searching. That's interesting, right? You know, it's now doing the searching. And out came here, quote unquote, the term industrial AI was introduced by Professor Jay Lee and his colleagues. They define it as a systematic discipline which focuses on developing, validating, deploying various machine learning algorithms for industrial applications with sustainable performance. And there's a link to the ResearchGate, June 2020. I downloaded that PDF, started reading it. So November 2020, that's exactly when you and I wrote or finished, published our book on AI and industry, right? And at that time, we started a year earlier, actually, already in German, our podcast. But there you go. So not sure that this is 100% correct, you know?
I thought it was invented by Boris Schöringer.
Yeah, later on. Yeah.
Kudos to Boris.
There you go, Boris. Looking forward to hearing from you. Now, actually, so then I got into the details, and then I found out that actually Jay Lee with, I assume, students had already introduced the concept in 2018. So Boris, if you were even before 2018, maybe you are the one. But there you go. Also, number two, I then asked it, what other media sources, maybe books, magazines, website, podcasts, have talked about industrial AI? And then, quote unquote, since the introduction of the term industrial AI by Professor Jay Lee and his colleagues, various media sources have explored the concept across multiple platforms. And then, number one, it says, Industrial AI Podcast.
Oh,
Peter. By Peter Seberg and Robert Reber and the rest.
So it's biased, right?
Sorry, what?
It's biased.
No, why? Oh, because it knows that I am.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe. Nevertheless, okay, we're not going to put more flowers into the air for ourselves. Anyway, so what I did, I then wrote Jay Lee, Professor Jay Lee, and asked him, you know, what can we learn from him? And he answered overnight. I did just yesterday. So I'm going to talk to him tomorrow. And in the meantime, that's what you saw. Oh, if we had only done this a little bit earlier, we could have met him, I guess, because he visited Davos a couple of weeks back and he did a presentation. And I saw this picture to ASML in Eindhoven.
Uh-huh.
And you and I, we recognize, of course, Jacek Kusra, who you
friend, okay. Right?
So, yes, Sundays, industrial AI. Actually, that's also when I find the time on Sunday, I go to LinkedIn. And if I still have options for connections left over, you know, there's always only a number, a total number of connections you can make in a week. Those of you that are aware of that fact.
So do you will record an episode with him?
Yeah, most certainly. Tomorrow.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, that's
tomorrow. Okay.
Yeah, I think tomorrow, Tuesday for us. Yeah. So
okay, perfect.
Hearing this, we will have succeeded already. Now, I was going to say, and then I look for, and that's how I got into it, I believe, because I look into.
It's a rabbit hole for you, right?
What? Industrial AI.
Exactly. When you go on Sunday on LinkedIn, and then there's a rabbit hole, you go deeper and deeper and deeper.
I have other things to do as well. Okay. That's why I say if I get into it, it's standing there in my calendar, I move it a week all the time, and I look at industrial AI, I search on LinkedIn. And in the meantime, I get more than 1,000 folks who have exactly the term. So the point is, this industrial AI as an activity has been growing so strongly over the years. And I make these connections with people, any of you people. You can make my life easier if you, dear listener, are into industrial AI. You know, send me a request for connecting, then I don't need to find you. Now, and then I'm going to close off with Google DeepMind. That's another final, very quick thing. because actually there was this, it's YouTube. I do a lot of YouTubes as well, the good ones. And that's with the Google DeepMind CEO, Demis Hassabis. We talked about him before. Maybe we can talk with him some point in time. And that was about the path to AGI. Everybody talking AGI. But, you know, if somebody's going to ask him, and Demis answers AGI is a handful of years away, then for me, that has meaning. Later on, he says, yeah, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. So then my answer to that was, okay, I'm going to work another 5 years and that's it.
Right. Kudos to Michael Gerstenauer from Kaber. We already talked about that last week because I met him in Linz and we always have our traditional breakfast meetup at
You told me.
Yeah, exactly. And we talked about AGI when it comes to robotics.
And what did he think?
He's very skeptical because robotics is different and is very difficult. And as we learned from the past episodes, reinforcement learning is a beast. So there is a lot to do when it comes to robotics. Yeah.
Yeah. What is AGI? I mean, there's a definition that Demis has. I think he talks about the intelligence, the artificial general intelligence has to be able to be at the same level or surpass any of human multimodal cognitive intelligence capabilities, right? And then I came to the pass about creativity. So, you know, it was about what's the game of Go? That's now whatever many years ago. I know even where I was listening at it was so impressive. And I recall the move 37, they talk about it. And that was kind of real creativity. But then he says, okay, so that was already number two, creativity. And then he says the next level we need is humans came up. A human can invent a game like Go, you know, and that was invented a couple of thousand years ago. So now what intelligence is going to invent the game? And of course, these days, the algorithms are inventing many different games. Let's stop here, but I understand that then bringing it into a robot and the robot being capable of doing things, you know, that we can do today, if that's what he thinks, I'm not that much detailed into it. So.
Perfect. Let's go to the main part because you talked to Andri from the University of Amsterdam about world robotic models. And another spoiler, Andri's boss, Professor Dr. Stathis Gaffis, director of the Qualcomm Lab in Amsterdam, will give also a workshop at AI in the Alps on world robotic models and agents. And Peter, why do we need world robotic models?
Oh, interesting. Actually, I mean, that's the number one topic that yesterday when I listened to Demis Hassabis on the past, who is AGI, you need, and I think so many other people have been saying that, Jan LeCun as well, you know, we need these models. And here we go again. It's really, and you will hear Andri say that, it's Jürgen Schmidhuber who came up with that idea many years ago. I'm not sure if it's 10 years longer ago. You need a model. I as a human have a model of the world around us, of the physical things happening, the sun getting up or rain and all the things happening around us. And that's what we need to give, so to say. That's what we have embedded in our being, whatever that is, that being. Being is our brain and our soul and our body and everything. And I think what the people who know what they talk about say, we need those models and for algorithms to be able to move forward, independent of the fact if you're moving towards AGI or moving towards having algorithms and artificial intelligence do sensible things for us humans.
So let's listen to Andri in the main part now. Peter, it was a pleasure. Again, thank you very much and all the best.
Thank you, Robert. Have a great day, dear listener. I hope to have you with us again soon. Bye-bye.
Enjoy your interview. Bye-bye.
My name is Peter Sieberg, and I'm your host. And today I'm going to be talking to Andri Zadayanchuk.
Wow, you did it correctly.
I did it correct the first time. And Andri does a postdoc at the University of Amsterdam. And Andri and I are going to be talking about robotic world models. Hi, Andri.
Hi, nice to be here. So Yeah, today I'm really excited to describe a bit the concept of word models, right? So first of all...
Yeah, but before you do that, introduce yourself, please. Who are you? What do you do for a living, if at all?
Yeah, I'm a researcher. So I enjoy kind of looking into new ideas. And I did my PhD in Germany, actually, in Tübingen. And then joined the University of Amsterdam, continuing my research and kind of trying to apply some of the ideas that were kind of applicable only in kind of fundamental research to more interesting settings that involves robotics. And this intersection, I think, is quite interesting now.
Sounds great. Yeah, we're going to be talking about your different sections later on in our podcast and see what we can learn from each other. You and I got to learn and meet each other at the Industrial AI Conference in Frankfurt. That's only a week or two ago. We actually started recording, but for whatever reason, we couldn't finish. So we just restart today. Now, in the meantime, so many things happened. One thing that happened was DeepSeek, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I wanted to refer to is we had Jan Le Cun speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Not so sure you saw that one. Anyway, I assume that you know his rough ideas, but he talks about the new paradigm of AI architectures, and he says the limitations that inhibit truly excellent intelligent behavior in machines is number one, the lack of understanding of the physical world. And, you know, there's two or three other ones. But before then, so that's, I think it's an introduction into the topic that we have today. But before we get into the robotic world models, which is the topic of today, maybe first a general discussion. What are models and how maybe do human models differ from what later on we're going to see as robotic models?
Yeah, indeed, human models are like always was an inspiration for researchers in AI, because if you would think about it, just making all the decisions without kind of creating a concepts or ideas how world works would actually be quite challenging for a human, because this would require to always remember what to do, know how world works. And this concept that we know how world works, and this is even more important, and we can use it to learn what to do, was actually explored in neuroscience. So it was a concept actually like around last 10 years that was kind of researchers from neuroscience were tackling ideas that, okay, if we have such a prefrontal cortex that is uniform and has a lot of similar kind of cortical columns, what can they do? Like if they model vision and auditory system, completely different things. And what they came up with, that the only thing that they can do, like as a general thing, would be prediction. So predicting the future. And this was the main kind of idea that, okay, if we want understanding of the world, we should be able to predict what would happen next. Right? So anticipate kind of what is possible to happen next, right? And it's quite intuitive because this can help us plan, right? We can think of, okay, if I don't know, buy a ticket, then no one would stop me when I'm registering for a plane and I can finally get to the Frankfurt and visit Industrial AI conference, right? And then it's happening. It's exactly how world works. And actually, this is not even related to physics now, right? So it's we as humans are creating models for ourselves because it is easy to live life, right? When everything is kind of predictable, I would say. So, yeah, so this way, yeah.
Now, humans, we don't have models, abstract representations of the world on purpose. We have them, I guess, implicitly. Is that a right word to say?
Yeah, indeed.
So we seem to know how the world works. If we if we look outside and we see leaves on the tree, that's a confirmation. Maybe that's depending on where in the world you are. It's summer or it's winter. Or
yeah, indeed.
And if you see snow falling down, you know that when you get outside. So our model says be careful, because so it is this abstract representation. Now, as I suggested, as you told us in Frankfurt, so how do then robotics, so moving into the robotic space, how would then robots train? How would they learn? How would they train differently and come to a certain abstract of the world different from humans?
Yeah, so here, first of all, I would start with a big challenge that was making a difference between a standard deep learning and a robotics plus deep learning, kind of robotics learning area. And there, what was a big obstacle was that robots need to interact with the real world, right, to collect data. And this was a big challenge because, and is kind of still a big challenge, because imagine like to set up a robot and get it to practice its own task, it is much longer than to kind of collect the data set from internet of a lot of images or something like this. That was the only needed requirement for training a standard, I don't know, image classifier or foundational models, that they would call it now. And the same applies to, like, imagine now you need to set up, like Google was doing, I don't know, 20 of those robots in the same room. And then you need to somehow make them learn, like, to repeat the same task again and again. And they can also break themselves if they do it wrong, right? So you need to have some safety requirements. And all of this was creating a lot of challenges because it's all interactions in the real world, right? So the idea was, what can we do to avoid this, right? And the traditional answer from industry would be, okay, let's ask an engineer, right, to sit and to create something that resembles the real world environment. And if it resembles it well enough, then maybe we can use this virtual environment or digital twin, as they would call it. And this was actually a good idea, right? So if you have a really particular environment and you want your robot to be good at one particular thing, right, then it would already be a useful idea to spend a half a year engineer work to recreate it, right? But yeah, let's say this was last, I don't know, 20 years already, right? In some sense, it's a traditional approach to do it.
It's like simulation, right?
Yeah. You create a simulation or digital twin such that, like, you check if the simulation is close to reality or not. And if it's not, your engineer continue working until it is close to in a particular setting. But what we got as a feedback also from companies like Toyota and so on was like, yes, but this is good until something changes. Until in half a year, in our factory, some rules changed or some small, I don't know, detail is not available anymore and we want to substitute it for another detail that is 2 millimeters longer or something like this. And sometimes these small details already change drastically the performance because your reality and simulation are not the same. So you need your engineer to be full-time kind of person supporting these digital twins. And this is not kind of a good thing, right? Because you cannot really rely on a kind of every time human would be thinking about what changed, because yeah, in the end it would be this world model that is not adaptable at all, right? And the idea was okay, already for 6 years to create some world models or better digital things, let's call them, that are really adaptable and can be learned, not just created from real world, right?
Right. And that's what you would call then an end-to-end world model, or?
Yeah, indeed. That's what people starting from, by the way, Schmidt-Huber would be, so he introduced the concept in 2017, would call a world model. So it would be kind of generative neural network, for example, that is able to generate the future given, for example, robotic actions, or like if you are talking about game, if you have a control of how you control a character, right? So the same keyboard pressing keys, right? You can add it to a neural network as an input, and you ask neural network to predict what would happen, to how visual observations would look like. So this was a general idea that if we have a lot of data, right, a tons of data about our real world, we can kind of compress it into a representation about this world. So representation would be a neural network that kind of gets as input a current observation and a particular actions. So action would be, as I said, for example, in game would be just controlling a character, for example, and then is able to predict the future. And this was some particular, like it was a big topic and is a big topic, right, in end-to-end learning. However, unfortunately, this has a big limitation. So in our work, we particularly try to tackle those limitations. If maybe you are interested, I can describe Cosmos.
Sure. Please do so. And I was just going to, I was waiting for you to finish there, but there is no development in AI without making a reference to Jürgen Schmidhuber.
Indeed.
If we don't do it, then Jürgen will do it himself, as he did 2 days ago, saying that DeepSeek is based on his reinforcement learning approaches.
Obviously.
But nevertheless, you say, yeah, sure, there he was, 2017, and this world not a concept is what you're using.
No, this is a clear case.
Yeah, please go ahead and do so.
Yeah, indeed. So it's there, it is no questions. He was really first person who was introducing them, so credits assigned. And now kind of people were thinking, okay, those introduced by Jürgen were like working, but they were mostly limited to something like a game, because games are quite predictable, right? So the games are like some rules or some graphics, like you can think of computer game like Counter-Strike or something like this, right? So they are still, in the end, are small words in the sense.
I only know Pong.
Well, yeah, this would work, right? If you,
that's more for my time. I haven't played Counter-Strike.
If you kind of compress all the images of Pong into a neural network, then it would be possible to play, basically interacting not with a simulator, but with a neural network all the time, right? So that was their idea. But unfortunately, if you try to do the same compressing, decompressing with autoencoders and variational autoencoders for something more realistic, something that would be more interesting for industry, actually, this like was not scalable, let's say. So last 2 years, I would say people tried to adapt this idea of a word model too much kind of more realistic neural network, so neural networks that are capable of modeling realistic inputs. And what are those? Like all of you know, I guess, about some DALL-E that can generate images that are indistinguishable, almost indistinguishable from real world. And last year, it was also a boom of next thing that would be video generation, like Sora, right? Sora, or recently there was VO2 that was really interesting, kind of video generation that resembles real world inputs, and they were all conditioned on some text. So you provide some text prompt, right? And output would be, I don't know, 10 seconds video, right? And while this is fun and can be really useful for some creative industries, like short films, exactly. All of this is like, I guess they are, it's a big, big, big game there. But what was additionally interesting, that if you think about it, and Sora was one of the first, while not being physically realistic at all, they were first to kind of introduce this concept that at some moment of the development of those video generation, they can serve as actually simulators of real world.
Right, because the big difference is maybe we're moving into physics here, or maybe we're moving into grounding the models, because the ones that you just mentioned, they can produce the most fancy imagery videos, and we may love it for that reason. But things may happen that are at least today, not physically possible, right? So that is the generative side without a grounding in the world as we know it, on one hand. And on the other hand, if we're going to be working with robots, we want him to understand, you know, the world as it is around him in a factory or in a home or elsewhere.
Yeah, indeed. So as for advertisement, it could be a benefit that you are able to imagine non-physical, nice kind of imaginations of, I don't know, non-existing creature.
Yeah, more flying through space. Exactly. Like a bird.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And this just works, right? So this would be a big benefit for them, but for someone who is really thinking about using this as a data generation, right? As we talked in the start of the talk, right, that we need more data for robotics, kind of. If we want to use this as a data generation, this should be really, really resembling real world. And any kind of deviation, small deviation from real world, like if you don't respect friction and your objects are just flying in the table without friction, then it's useless, right? Your predictions would be unrelated to what would happen in the real world afterwards. So whatever you learn inside these imaginations are not applicable in the real world. Thus, it was a huge kind of a question, and it is a huge question, is it a way to make them realistic? And maybe that's a kind of next steps, how to make those large generative models more realistic. And a lot of people,
please tell us, are there ways to do it already today, or are you working on that?
Exactly. Yeah, a lot of people are working on it, and we decided that, okay, what would be the minimal things that we really want from a world model, right? And we realized that actually we want our world model to be physical first, meaning that it should be quite closer to the simulator, right? And humans in this sense potentially are the same. They don't care that much about, let's say, small visual detail, because this would not affect how things behave, right? But they do care a lot about some kind of deviation in the trajectory prediction, how trajectory of the object would evolve if I push it, or something like this. So we thought, okay, let's actually start from what we have now as a best physics available in the virtual world. And this would be physics simulator, right? Engine, physics engine. And yeah, those are developed by engineers, but in contrast to digital twins, right? They are general purpose physics engines. So they literally can model many different physical processes, and for everyday robots, like it is a lot of things that are happening are quite simple in terms of physics if we are talking about manipulation, right? So manipulation would be, the simplest example would be pick and place, right? You take an object and you want to place it into some different location, and quite often this would be already like your dishwasher, like putting things into and putting things out. In the end, it's a lot of pick and place examples, right? So it's a lot of subtasks that would be literally just pick and place, right? So this leads us that, okay, physics are not that complex in some of the robotics tasks, and we can use physics engines somehow to help us there. But however, what we are missing is a connection to real world, right? So like physics engines are general purpose thing, and we need some way to make an interface between a real world and scene that we observe now. So you can imagine a table and an object on top of this table, right? And a robotic arm that tries to manipulate those objects, right? So this would be a good example to think of, okay, how we can connect those real objects in the kind of table that we observe and physics engine, right? So for this, we came up with trying to use and using kind of a realistic representations of the world, right? Of the scenes in our case, and making them exactly suitable for later being used as a, you know, part of world model, basic. So how do you start? You start from kind of, you need to reconstruct your original scene, right? If you cannot reconstruct the geometry of the object, then kind of it would be useless in sense that any simulator would assume that you know how your objects are look like, but not only how they look like in terms of pixels, right? But more like how they look like in terms of objects and their meshes. And in this sense, it's a big difference from all the Cosmos and other generative, video generative models that adapted as world models, because they generate pixels of everything together, of all of the scene together, right? And what simulator that has connection to physics engine would assume would be more like it assumes a set of meshes. A mesh is just a representation of the geometry for the object, right? And the kind of appearance, meaning how the texture of the objects would look like. So this too gives you ability to render this object. So maybe something like something like asset 3D representation of the object, right? And we decided that, okay, if you start from those, but would make them really suitable for later be used in the world models, then maybe we can get a lot of progress. And for this, we use Gaussian splatting. It's a new technique that combines really fast rendering and fast training, right? So for robotics, it's really, really nice because you're given a set of images of a particular scene. So imagine that robot was just walking around or something like this around the scene with a camera, right? Collecting an images of a particular scene. It could be, in our case, around 90 images, but we hope to get to much less images in the future.
So Gaussian splatting is the technology moving from pixels to objects, or?
Let's say to 3D. That's the main part of this. So to from 2D pixels to let's call them 3D pixels, right? And then because Gaussian splattings are also kind of explicit 3D representation, so that they have these coordinates in 3D space, so where each splat is located, right? Then we can actually use standard foundational models for segmentation in 2D, meaning that if we decompose a scene into objects in 2D, then for Gaussian splatting, it's really easy to create an object-centric Gaussian splat, meaning that we combine many Gaussians together as one object, kind of, by using the masks obtained from something like SAM2. Maybe you know segment anything model that is able to produce segments of any objects. And this model was really like not having little assumptions about underlying scenes, categories of the objects. It was just trained to be working on random unseen objects. And that's why it is really useful as zero-shot kind of foundational model for scene decomposition. And we use these segmentations together with Gaussian splatting, combine them together to get object-centric Gaussian splats.
Okay, so what does that mean? Where are you standing then in your research, moving from, you know, physics-less Gen AI towards a, you know, physics-based world model?
Yeah, so we are trying to kind of stay in the middle in a sense that like realisticness of the images rendered or generated by video generative model, right, is still quite a nice property to have. And this was a big problem of gap of sim to real, right? So when robots were trained well in simulation, but were breaking in reality. And we try to make our dream to manipulate world model such that it has this property of rendering realistic scenes. So rendering images that would look really like a real world. And this brings us closer to this video generative model in the sense that we care about, right, this plausibility of the outputs, but we still care a lot that underlying structure of the scene is still discovered and learned, right? And this is a big difference from all video generative models that don't care about discovering and using structure of the world. So in this sense, we are trying to exploit what engineers were already done in creating really powerful physics engines and combine them with a power of, let's say, 3D scene representation that could be really neural. If we, let's say, it's one of the interesting follow-up works to make it fully neural, but currently it's just a really already working well optimization from a set of images you learn to represent your world realistically. So this combination gives us interesting abilities that we can discuss kind of as a next topic later.
Right. So is it still going to be, you're looking towards a combination of not just saying, you know, a producer, what do I have here? A cup of tea. I have the cup of tea fly through the air. Doesn't normally work unless I throw it maybe. And moving towards, I'm a product designer, a produce a cup of tea. So you're still going to get your whatever you're going to say. It needs to be green or blue or thick or thin or whatever. But then you're going to result in a cup of tea that it will not probably fly through the air, but it's going to be sitting there on a table and it's going to have a world model representation such that if I'm going to feed these cups into a production line, then they're going to behave in the same way that these cups will behave in real life.
Yeah, quite similar. So having a connection between your real world objects, and that's important, objects, because that's a simplest structure of the world, right? So in some sense, the objects are things that we can easily model independently from other things, kind of, and this leads us to creating a set of assets, right? And if we know these assets well and we can work with them in the simulation, right? Then we literally have much more kind of learning abilities in the simulations that we would have before this, right? So this would be kind of trying, if you have a production line, literally having all the independent parts of this kind of important parts of the production line or your products and so on, to have their own representation in the simulation.
Yeah, I understand. So what does then not yet make your dreamer a world model? What is still lacking? And maybe in combination with, do you share what you have to date? Can other people, interested listeners, researchers, other folks get involved as well? Or?
Yes, so definitely. Fortunately, the paper was just published in iClear. iClear is fully open. You can already download the paper there, but we also have archive, and soon it would be released code. So meaning that we are releasing like everything that what we have done during working on Drema. And we are also really interested in extending and tackling some of the limitations of Drema to kind of make a next step, if you want, world model that still would be in this new area of so-called real to sim, meaning that we take things from reality and put them fully in the imagination or in the world model while being more neural. And yeah, so we are quite open to any kind of collaborations or looking for more ideas around it, and like to help in thinking about this, I can start with describing some of the limitations that we clearly see.
Please do. I was going to say, so with the real to sim, you're back to the start. So then you're going to be sim to real to sim to real to sim.
Exactly. It's always like this. Yeah.
Okay. So it's
real to sim doesn't make sense.
Right.
Real to sim doesn't make sense without second part, without a part sim to real. So it's usually real sim to real kind of. And this makes a really fun scene, right? You're putting things from reality to simulation. You're playing with them safely and a lot because computer is cheap while data is expensive. So you're playing with them a lot in the simulation, and then you're putting back your policy or your robot in the real life. So let's say that's a real, sim to real, it's about robot actions, and real to sim, it's about objects or assets, right? And this is really nice that it's two different kind of combinations.
But in both ways can learn from each other, is that right? It's not just the one of the other, but it's...
Indeed, yeah, exactly. You need each of them to actually create a full system that is kind of sustainable, in a sense that you kind of, without copying from real world your assets, right? Whatever you would learn in simulation would be not useful in the real world. But without learning a lot in simulation, you cannot really modify your kind of existing assets such that you're robust and your policy is really successful in the real world. So you need both components of the puzzle. And maybe this was a bit of a missing part in previous RL kind of, it was a big scene to real, but it was missing puzzle, part of the puzzle, real to scene kind of. And that's what we are in some sense trying to fill as a gap, yeah.
So feel free to share what are your next steps to move towards a, you know, perfect world model.
Yeah, so currently, as I started, right, we needed quite many views to construct this initial scene that would be object-centric Gaussian splatting. However, it's not really necessary. If you have a powerful, for example, video generative model, then you can actually connect its kind of latent space or something like this with generating directly those Gaussian splats with a neural network itself. That's not how it's currently done, but it clearly could be done easily. So this would mean that we would be really interested into end-to-end training of our DREMA world model, having all the components kind of communicating with each other. And this also makes it much less kind of hungry on initial data. If you have a guess, for example, of how cups look like, right, in this video generative model, you clearly can have a guess by giving a text of a cup, and then you would generate a lot of cups, right? And this concept that we already have these beliefs about objects in the neural network can help a lot into making learning of those Gaussian splattings much, much faster and only relying on several views. So not on 90 views, but on 4. Right, that would be a nice progress, I would say. And yeah, this is like making it more neural, I would say. And next, obviously, now we are currently limited with simple objects, I would call them, meaning that they are solid bodies, solid objects. And while this is nice for initial, you know, investigation, if we want really to apply it in industry, then what we would need is to generalize our DREMA model into all more flexible objects. So deformable objects, for example, right? If I want a robot that is able to, I don't know, manipulate a rope or do a knit, right? So something that is actually flexible is much more difficult to simulate, and we know this, right? So let's say combining more powerful physics simulations that are able to tackle these deformables, but also there you need Gaussian splatting that is kind of flexible, right? So that would change when your robot, when your objects change their shape. And this is a really interesting active area of research to make Gaussian splatting representations flexible so that they are also deformable together with an object kind of.
Okay, make sure that you share, maybe you did already, the URLs of the paper, of the work that you have been doing for others to have a look at. Now, as I suggested before at the beginning, you said you did your PhD actually in Germany, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
In Tübingen, right?
In Tübingen, yeah, near Stuttgart.
You were at the ETH in Zurich as well, and now you're Amsterdam. And I recall I asked that question before in the piece of the podcast that we had to redo. Where were things different? How can we learn maybe from each other? What were your typical experience in those different sites?
Yeah, so far I actually try to have best of both worlds in my let's say, work ethic and like thinking about how to do things. But what I learned so far was, for example, that some things in Germany were a bit more regulated than I would, let's say, regulated, but not in a way, not in a productive way. And while Max Planck Institute is really well at trying to help and isolate you from this bureaucratic struggles, that's really a lot of credits to Max Planck. But I would say for the whole Germany, it would be obviously a bit of benefit to stay more closer to this flexibility that I observe in Netherlands, but the flexibility that still has rules. So it's not about absence of the rules, it's about that the rules make sense. And by making sense, I mean that if you need 12 forms just to confirm some of the visit to some place, right, then much more people would avoid starting in the first place. For example, if you have a company and a lab and a research lab, that's a good example, I think. And then you want those two work together. And you want one to give money to research lab, right, for some particular purpose. And this is happening, Bob, obviously, in Germany also. But it felt much more smooth kind of in Netherlands, where this was made almost like a standard, right, that they created a system that was really making it obvious for a company, not even biggest company, not, you know, you don't need to be an Amazon or someone to do this collaboration in Netherlands, because they really created a simple rules. And if you give money and if you have an infrastructure, like computer or something, right, and you can have a proposal for university to have a postdoc or someone who is working with you as a company, and the rules are simpler. Right. So in this sense, it creates a bridges between industry and science. And in machine learning, sorry, but that's what must have, right? It's not really an option. It should be just a priority, I would say, to have these bridges, right? Because machine learning is a bit unusual science. It requires a lot of kind of compute from one side, but also a lot of flexibility and motivation from, for example, some industry could be really nice way of, you know, pushing forward some of the aspects of machine learning, I would say.
Okay. But you said you combined the best of both worlds. So there were other aspects that you did like a lot.
So for me, as it's my also personal so far opinion, it's kind of from Germany, I kind of learned that sometimes this longer term vision, not vision, but
approach.
Yeah. So I was seeing sometimes kind of people who was like role models for me, who were like, yes, we want to contribute in like 10 years perspective. And they consistently try to do it systematically, right? And obviously this is just I may be biased. So that's what I was seeing for 5 years of my PhD, and I'm only 1 year in Netherlands. But I feel that sometimes, like, providing the security of longer term kind of commitments, possibility of the commitment, is really making a difference.
Yeah, which maybe has worked very good in the last 50 years. Maybe it's not working that much or all the time anymore today. Again, it's always about learning from each other. And maybe for my final question to you, we're looking at a higher level, we're looking at the world, you know, what can Europe learn from China, from the US, and vice versa. So I do want to know that from you as well. So tell us a little bit, 2-3 more things, a little bit about your current workplace. What do you do? How does a typical day for a postdoc at the University of Amsterdam, right, look? You know, who are your colleagues? What do you do?
Mm-hmm. So, like, being somewhere intermediate between, let's say, professors and faculty and PhD students and master students is an interesting role, in the sense that, like, you combine necessity to actually work actively on your own and make your primary contributions, like first author papers or something like this, but still you need to work and kind of communicate a lot with kind of PhD students, with master students, with your professor, and be this bridge in some sense between high level vision and low level details. So every the standard day would be combining part of the day, or let's say having some days in the week where you focus on your own project and try to be super active in standard, running experiments, coding, doing reading, writing, obviously. And then it would be almost half or more time, in my case, at least sometimes, where you concentrate on planning, but on more detailed level. On planning of the details such that the project would be really successful, right? So if the student is stuck somewhere, right, you try to find a paper or find the really solution, right? Let's say the simplest possible solution. And or sometimes the problems are really simple, right? It could be not a, high level questions about science. It could be cluster related challenge that some script is not running somewhere for a week or two, right? And then, you're feeling okay, if I figure out how to run the script in one day, this could already make a progress for this PhD student for next 2-3 weeks, yeah. Right? So,
yeah, I've had similar experiences, but maybe 30 years ago. It sounds like a fun working environment. I always personally love to be in a university environment with students around me. And I think it's very, very important that the students understand and realize what a wonderful, perfect position they're in to be able to study. Coming to a close, Andre, we had Jensen Huang, is that right? From NVIDIA, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, something happened the last since we saw each other.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that 600 billion got cut off the market capitalization, but before that he announced the year of physical AI. That sounds very much like what we've been talking to you. I mean, of course, NVIDIA, but also you making that possible. And the second thing, this morning, I had actually asked the ChatGPT to give me a daily update on, what's happening on industrial AI. And this morning, the headline was AI-powered robots transforming warehouses. Now, that's another, just showing the direction of the work you are doing, you making it possible. So at a top level, where are we? Where are we standing? You in and around the University of Amsterdam in Europe, you worked in Germany, the things that you see coming from DeepSeek, China, United States, where do you see things happening, around the world of robotics in the next, as far as you can see, couple of years?
Yeah, so it was also really interesting to observe, DeepSeek. Reading the paper was actually quite pleasant experience, meaning that you finally get the details, and I understand. So those details are reinforcement learning. That's a starting thing from which I was starting my PhD, and it works in quite different areas, right? So from robotics to getting finally kind of this close to reasoning abilities, right? But I'm always careful while using each day in Cursor, both DeepSeek and what else? A really good one, this Mini, O3, blah, blah, Mini. That is also quite...
Yeah, exactly. They were announced just afterwards. Yeah, right. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I think that shows us a bit, right? So what is happening is the ideas are simple enough if they manage to put them in the papers like this, in 12 pages, I think, or 8 pages paper. The ideas are not that difficult. The training scale, right? So that was, I think, the biggest change, that they were reporting how much it was costing them, and it was costing them less, right? And this is good news for everyone, right? In the end, it may be temporary, not good news for 1-2 weeks of the company who were not doing it that cheap, But in 1-2 weeks, they would do it at least as cheap, right? If it's possible. Because it was an open source, it was released in quite a kind of, obviously, it's easy to release when your purpose is to be this disruptor, right? And not to be elite of the market. But in the end, this makes a pressure to anyone who leads the market to be faster and to be simpler and cheaper, right? Otherwise, you would not survive in the market when you have an open source DeepSeek R1 that I can privately run on my kind of machines. That's what I see.
And to stay with that, I mean, DeepSeek is just an example, but that happens the same in the world of robotics. And how do the students around you, how do they react to that? Do they say, wonderful, great, look at that, open source, we can do that, let's start. Do you see a change? I mean, do all of them say, you know, we must move to the United States because that's where things are happening, or no, we can stay here in Amsterdam, or go to Tübingen, or go to Denmark, or it doesn't matter where we go. Do you experience they have this feeling that, you know, they can do things even with smaller budgets, so to say?
That's a good question. Not that I directly experience, just to be sincere. I would say what I see is like everyone who has access to open video generative model like Cosmos was publishing, right? Or to DeepSeek or to combination of them as a researcher feels a bit more empowered because obviously not everything in the research is about creating the next one big model, but it is so many questions that you can answer kind of carefully if you have access not only to the, you know, closed sourced API, but to the model itself. So I feel like it is much easier to brainstorm, like seeing a paper and a model that is working in your hands as a researcher about what are exciting new ideas. And then compute for inference always was much smaller, right, than compute for training. And that I see a sweet point. Like we have a compute for fine-tuning. So meaning that you start from those foundational models, right? But then you really nail it into something that works really well by tuning it, kind of. And this is, I think, what a lot of researchers feels more empowered while having this open source model than they was 2 years ago when it was an impression that, okay, without ChatGPT and API calls, you cannot do research, right? And this was a shame, right? For researchers, really, that feeling, I would say, that you need to pay a company to do your research, right? So it's kind of, at least for me, the most unusual feeling that I had, that like you really needed to discuss a budget for ChatGPT API calls. And now it's not the case anymore. Everyone can start a research openly in Europe, right? Without big demand of kind of negotiate. And in Europe, it's much easier to negotiate compute than to negotiate access or payments to, you know, US-based API calls. So this was actually, I think, making life of researchers easier. And I would say a bit more exciting because you have all these tools that are much, like, they are powerful. And now it's a question, for example, in robotics, we have so many tools that can generate a crazy environments in which robots can learn, right? So, like, I would expect next 2 years to be just explosion of these ideas of kind of using code generation, for example, to create really powerful kind of playgrounds or world models or just environments in which robots are really nail their tasks, such that they are then really useful in the real world, right? And all of this you can test for free, meaning that you need a lot of compute, but you don't need a lot of real world robots, kind of that a lot of labs cannot afford, right? So in Netherlands, for example, it's still possible to easily get access to the Snellius so-called cluster, a big compute. But it is more difficult for a lab to say, we need 20 robots, please, we need them next year, right? So this thing is not happening, right? So in this sense, I think the more we would go to this exploiting available open models and transforming them into tools that are useful for other areas like robotics, right? The more we would get a progress in those areas that we were not even expecting in the first place. And this is quite exciting.
Thank you very much, Andriy. We're going to continue to follow the worlds of open and as long as there's going to be closed source as well. Let's see who's going to take what position. Thank you very much. So those of you listeners who want to get in touch with you can do that by LinkedIn, probably best. We're going to put your reference in the show notes. Otherwise, if you, dear listeners, have any questions, comments, as always, please send me a short email, peter@aipod.de. Very happy that you stay with us so far. Looking forward to have you again with us next time. And Andriy, thank you very much. It was great meeting you in Frankfurt and great talking to you again here online.
Yeah, it was really nice to talk to you. And as I said, we are quite open to collaboration. So we would be excited to see what would be the next things that we can do, like with manipulation word models like Dremel.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.